I'll post this on the Facebook account so that you can see it. But basically, it was my run at why I am a Christian. And I attempted not to turn around and just make it a list of arguments that say, here's an argument for God. Here's an argument for God from cosmology. Here's an argument. What it was, I tried to answer it in the way that I actually feel like people really answer questions. And if I got no other point across last class, if I could make any point to this kind of stuff at all, it would be that people demand of things like religion a higher standard of proof or evidence or reasons for believing than they do everything else in their lives. And when people ask, and I think the answer to a lot of questions that people ask, legitimate questions, like why, if God could just prove by doing a miracle that he exists, why doesn't he just do that miracle? And I think the answer to that question is something like this. I think God gives us evidence of the kind that we use to believe all the other things that we believe. So that is to say, if you are a scientific type of person, I think that God provides you evidence in science. If you're a philosophical type of person, I believe God will provide good evidence in philosophy. In parts of the world and times of the world where they believe things based on signs and miracles, God gave them signs and miracles. But the one thing that we don't believe based on in Western scientific culture is based in miracles. Why? What's the automatic assumption when someone says, here's a miracle that just occurred over here? What does everybody automatically say? There's a rational explanation for it. Where is Chris Angel? Where is some other magician? You know, what was it photoshopped? Was there some sort of video modification going on? How do we know? And I've literally sat down with atheists and had them say, if Jesus appeared in front of me, just appeared, levitating 2 feet off the ground, showed me the holes in his hands, I still wouldn't believe it because I might be hallucinating. Okay, they're not wrong. It might be the case that they're hallucinating. But my point is, if your standard of proof is that high and the miraculous doesn't answer it, then don't ask God, then don't question why God doesn't give you miraculous evidence. And I really do believe that the evidence that people need to see God is right there in front of them in the form that they want, if they bother to look for it. I really do think that is it. The whole ask and it will be given you, seek and you will find, knock and it will be opened unto you. I think that's true. And I think even a modest amount of inquiry will start to lead you down a path where you say, you know, this isn't something that I can ignore. It's something I need to look into. So that wasn't, you know, the point. I put a lot of other stuff in here. I ran through a lot of it very quickly last time. But generally speaking, what I said was when you hold Christian beliefs up to those standards, I think Christian beliefs far exceed a lot of the other stuff on which we base a lot of our beliefs in life. Carl.
I think just one point I would like to add on that is I think a lot of times atheists will say, but this decision is so important, right? That whether or not God exists is a bigger deal. I mean, you're talking about where someone's going for eternity, right? What's going to happen in terms of a life and death situation. And so I want to, they will say, okay, so I want to apply a higher standard. I think at a minimum, the appropriate analogy is we have jurors who go in and decide innocence and guilt routinely in our courthouses every single day. And the standard is beyond a reasonable doubt. And people are convicted of murder or found not guilty of murder routinely based off basic evidence that's presented in court. And often those cases, there may not even be an eyewitness to the crime. People are regularly convicted of murder on purely circumstantial evidence. Now, granted, there's lots of flaws with our criminal justice system, and you could say, well, people have reached some wrong conclusions and DNA has exonerated people, but the reason I bring it up is because people are willing to commit to that decision, whether or not a person should spend the rest of their life in jail, or whether or not a person should die, based off that type of evidence.
Right.
And so I think it's intellectually dishonest when people then say, well, to believe in God, it's got to be beyond a shadow of a doubt. It has to be, you know, and then people say, well, I might be hallucinating if Jesus appeared to me. That's just nonsense. And I think if you take people back to that criminal context, it helps them realize that they too would be willing to make a life or death decision without supernatural evidence.
Well, I'll tell you a life or death decision. Has anybody ever had the flu shot? Let me recast what the flu shot is to you. Now, by the way, I get the flu shot too, so I'm not anti-vaccine. Let me tell you what you're doing. You go to a clinic, sometimes the pharmacy, to a pharmacist that you didn't meet until that day. via an acquisition chain that you have no idea what it actually is. You could not trace that med from who just brought it into the pharmacy. And even if the guy, the bottle that he draws or she draws it from, you didn't even check the label on that one. They're going to inject you with the shells of viruses from which they claim to have pulled out the RNA. I sure hope that they got that right. Of a disease that has killed millions of people. And if they got that wrong, they didn't just inject into you something for your system to learn how to beat it on. They might have what if they accidentally injected you with the actual virus? And a particularly bad form of the virus. You are a dead man. But yet, we, with a very limited amount of faith of some sort, in this whole, in the system as it is set up, with good reason behind it. My point is, you make a life and death decision just getting the flu shot.
I think we're making the question too simple, because it's not a matter of truth, really, for most people. I look back at my own experience and I think I was more like C.S. Lewis in that I was angry at God because he didn't exist.
Yes.
Right? I have this sort of conundrum of thought. I don't think it's that people can truly and deeply say there's no God. I think that's more of a pride and an anger thing. I think it's that people look at the world and think that if God has created the world, that it's not the way it should be, and he's not who I thought he should be.
And I agree with, so, and what he's references here, obviously many of you know already, but the problem of pain and maybe not the logical, and the problem of evil. The logical problem of evil has been well answered for anybody that's interested in looking at it. But the emotional problem of that one, where one looks around and says, how could God possibly, and fill in the blank with anything else that goes on out there. Now that is a different question, but I agree with you. I do think that that is the number one reason that people have trouble accepting God as their leader, as their Lord. Now I think there are classes of people that don't fit under that one, but I think the vast majority do. And we have that's a great unpaid, again, transition to something that we are hoping to do here. So we're trying to write several things in this class. One of the things that we have said is very important, good that you're sitting right beside him as well, we are very much want to do some videos, maybe modeled on something like the minute physics stuff, just kind of a simplistic, not making it too simple, but there's a simple version, a short version out there, and then a more in-depth one that talks about one of the quote-unquote solutions that we have come up with in Solid Ground to the problem of evil, the problem of pain. So we're very interested in that. I do agree that that's the number one reason. But I didn't address that in my particular.
Most people won't say it like that because right. The logic becomes much more strong when you can lean on just the logic. But people are not 100% purely logical beings.
There's an emotional side to it that it always gets driven for a reason, but it doesn't always get put into their calculus, that's for sure. Great point. Thank you. Okay. Other comments, considerations, questions, challenges? Skyler, you sat through the whole last time. Where am I wrong on this one?
I think the...
For background, by the way, some of Skyler's major justification of why he believes what he believes is a lot of, it seems to me, correct me if I'm wrong, that you got there a lot through Pascal's wager. Okay, so that's just as background, that's where Skyler's coming from.
Yeah, the idea, you know, Carl's point about evidence and life and death, if God was asking you to do something morally reprehensible in order to achieve salvation, I think there's a lot to that. I mean, the argument would be hard. God is just asking you to lead the best possible life. I mean, even if you are an atheist or an agnostic, what's the downside? What is the downside? I mean, yes, you will, all the teachings of sacrifice and those things that go into the challenges of leading a Christian life. But in the end, we have a lot of teaching and a lot of testimony that you'll actually have a happier, more beneficial life even here, even in this plane of existence. So even if you just want to be the best person you can be with a chance of salvation, even if you approach it as a skeptic, you take that belief, lead that life, or start down that path and see if that leads you. It's not, I think there's kind of this myth or this desire to frame this as
an all or nothing, believe, and then you will have that life. If you are a skeptic, start down that path. Start leading the life. Start walking the walk, and then see if that leads you to faith.
So I want to add on to what Skylar has to say here, because although my philosophical justification differs from Skylar's and Pascal's in this case, which says you might as well, what Skylar started talking about right there really led to the twist that I like to put on it. Now, the twist is not a philosophical twist. The twist, except that it's an epistemic twist. It's one that says what he was getting at kind of at the end there. Well, I guess through the whole thing, I consider that data collection. I consider that saying, here's the hypothesis. God says do it this way. Everybody else says do it that way. Now, there's more than two questions. We're guilty of oversimplification here. But let's say that it's in a circle of possible direction. God's directions are in this direction, and the majority of them are kind of in opposite directions. And if that's the case, look at the hard data, both in your own life experientially, which is what I said I wanted to do. I wanted to experience the data for myself, but then also go look at the scientific data that are out there. So I was running short on time, but this is why I cited the Global Happiness Survey that basically says, you know, I extracted a few points from that one. The 20 people who report being happiest, the 20 happiest nations in the world, have significant long-running multi-century Christian, Judeo-Christian backgrounds. And I don't think that's a coincidence. I think that's there for a reason. I don't think it's just correlation. I think there's causation there too. And then the next thing that I set out is, even in those countries, the mean happiness level in the happiest countries in the world is a 7.5 on a scale of 10. I'm a 9 plus on a scale of 10 for happiness right now. So I know that the belief system I have makes me happier than the average person in the best country in the whole world for happiness. I don't think that those data are to be ignored. Additionally, I add to it that when I have done what Skylar has talked about, I know God said live life this way, chose my wife that way, I chose doing certain things that way. Those turned out to work out really, really well. And things that I chose that I was like, I'll blow that off and do what I clearly want to do intuitively and with the great encouragement of the culture around me, those turned out to work out not well. If you, a scientist that ignores those kind of data, taking into account observation bias and all that kind of stuff, is a scientist that's not interested in the question. Because those are real data, they are germane, they are important, and for us to just blow those off and act like they're not there is to put one's head in the sand. Yes, sir.
With your flu shot analogy, so you said that even though we don't know where they took the stuff, we just sort of have faith that it's safe or something. So in the context with your reasons for believing in God, does that mean that we only have good I'm gonna try to phrase this the best I can. We only have good reasons to believe that we can only know like so far.
Yeah, you're right. I didn't develop what I really meant by the flu analogy. What I mostly meant by the flu analogy is when you turn around and you ask some basic questions about this flu shot that you're willing to put in you under your own skin in order to say, I believe that this might save my life if I get the flu. It will make me not get sick if I get the flu. And I also think that it won't kill me. It won't do anything bad to me other than the normal kind of reaction one might have to an injection of that type. The reality is people who will say that is a good, scientific, modern thing to do. When you ask the question of, well, why? How is that significantly different when it comes to vetting the information of why you decided to do that versus why Christians, well-thought, well-reasoned Christians, believe what they believe? And my point would be this. There are some basic questions that nobody asks of the flu shot. Who are you, pharmacist, may I see your credentials that indicate that you actually have some medical schooling? We don't ask that question. Where did you get this from? Show me the chain of acquisition where this came from. What warehouse was it shipped from? Who was the manufacturer? What's the show me the FDA seal on this one. Yet when we ask that question, when people say, well, the Bible, it's life and death important, they will say, I want to see the chain of acquisition. I want to know it exactly right. There better not be any errors. I want to know it back to the exact same person. I want to be able to know from that point that it was, quote unquote, manufactured in such a way that it was consistent 100% with the truth. It better not be wrong at all. You can't even tell me what country that your flu shot was manufactured in. You can't tell me the name of the company that did it. You can guess it's Sanofi Pasteur, and you got some 20% chance of being right or something like that, but you don't even know. I don't even know. I'm not you, anybody. So my point is solely that people will set a bar for religious belief that they don't actually carry off anywhere else in life. It's the only place in life that they carry their bar. And one of the points that I was making about is most published research wrong. I wasn't making it. The guy from Veritaserum was making it, Veritasium. He's basically making the point of, you know, it's not something you can automatically trust. There has to be some verification going on to it, and you can't make the assumption that just because a system that you trust supports it that is true. So really, what the point that I was making there was, I'm just trying to set the standard for when I do my own reasoning of I'm not going to carry the burden of having to prove to you my own belief in Christianity hits this ultra high bar when you don't even have that burden for life and death decisions you make in your life. I will exceed your standard of what you say is the reason I believe things, and this is the way that I would do it. So that's really what I meant to say by the flu analogy. People have faith in authorities that they haven't even verified, and they believe things that they've been told to be true because they believe it, because basically the rest of the country believes it and they're happy and consistent, and it seems like a lot of people don't die from getting the flu shot, and that's the good test. Well, all those things can be said exactly about Christian faith and still be true. So why do people say it's one way and the other? So Randy, and then James, and then Lang. Lang's telling me something I'm doing wrong.
No.
Okay. Randy.
My initial response would be you do have an ability to verify those answers in a way that you cannot do with Christianity. If you really, when you go to the pharmacist, you can actually find out, you can ask them, where did you go to school? The fact that they're wearing the pharmacy outfit generally indicates that they're probably well-trained and educated, but you could press them. A lot of them put their certificates on the wall. If you wanted to, you could probably go to the CVS website or go to the Walgreens website, find out where exactly, which company they come from. You can probably actually find videos online of how they manufacture. If you want to do that for empirically showing that Christ existed, then that's, I would push back and say, no, you cannot do that in the same way, at least. You might have some evidence, but it's not to the same degree. Now, I like what Skylar was saying, though, and saying, like, he didn't just say, you don't have anything to lose, you should do it, but he says, you don't have anything to lose by believing, so you should test it. And so if it doesn't work out for you, then pull back.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that point because I kind of doubled down on it. I want to disagree with you slightly. You're right, it's not a direct analogy. Every analogy is going to break down a little bit. But I'll disagree with you slightly on the influenza vaccine for the following reasons. It's not, I think that you can, so I have 2 points. One, it is the case that you can verify those things, but my point is nobody does. Nobody does. And yet they still make that decision. So point one, it's simply that nobody does do that. It's a standard that one could do, but no one actually does. With respect to can you do it, consider the flu shot that I'm bringing up. It's not, you can go to a video online and see how flu shots are made. The question is your flu shot, that little vial, what was in your hypodermic, is that needle, a syringe, is that right there trustable? So if you say, well, I want to go back and verify that chain all the way back, you might actually find that that can't be done. But yet we trust it anyway, because it at least came in the box of the people that you trust. And if I think that's a direct analogy to Scripture, Because when you turn around and say, can you test it and investigate it, the time that you're going back from the time your vaccine was manufactured may only be 3 months in time. And yeah, we're going back 2,000 years in time to verify the other one. So there will be, I will certainly allow some more questions about an event that happened 2,000 years ago rather than an event that happened 3 months ago. But my point is, you probably can verify either one of those appropriately to the time frame that you're talking about. And I would like to say that I think that the standard of scripture and scholarship there and historical scholarship meets or exceeds that other standard that we're talking about. So I see your point is a good point, but I would offer those two as well in mitigation. And then James.
So I understand the main point, but I think it's too simple. I think if you're talking about the answer that everyone's always looking for, life, the universe, and everything else,
yes,
that needs to be at a higher standard than, say, a flu shot. Like, you died, there's still an afterlife if you went and looked for this answer. So even if I trusted the doctor to give a flu shot and I ended up dead, I'd still have faith in something beyond, or I would have had time to go and look and see what I actually want to believe in. Or
Granted. I mean, ultimately, if the Christian hypothesis is true, what weighs in the balance is not mere life and death, it's eternal life and death. So you're to that point, yes, there is no higher pot on which you're gambling. There is no higher there are no higher stakes. But my point there would be, maybe I could say irrelevant for this reason. What about this? In either case, if you take the if your quest for truth is this high standard up here, but the you don't know, right? So you're not a Christian. You're not James. You're asking the question. You're looking at Buddhism. You're looking at secularism. You're looking at Christianity. You're looking at Zoroastrianism, you know, whatever it is. You're looking at all these different things to evaluate. And you're like, all right, well, in the meantime, I'm going to go get the flu shot. Well, if you get killed, you don't even have time to make that decision. So you're actually betting that decision on the flu shot. Why? Because you need the research time to get that question done. So you are making an eternal life and death decision by getting the flu shot, because it will terminate your ability to inquire any further if you get it wrong. I'm making the flu shot sound like it's lethal. Like, you know, you're just, be careful going in CVS, you could walk out dead. That's not what I mean to say. Obviously, y'all see the point. I'm sorry, Lang and then Randy.
I was going to piggyback on that. That's actually what the objection was, and then I thought through basically what you just articulated more clearly. Like, yes, it is.
Well, sorry for missing your point the first time.
No, I didn't make it, but that was my initial, I didn't erase the objection.
Okay. Sorry for not reading your mind properly. Still working on that one.
Yeah.
Roger that.
My point was quite similar to James. You pretty well made it, that the decision about whether or not to take a flu shot is the same decision you make by getting on a bus or in a train or an airplane. You're trusting somebody.
The airplane one's my other one. I like the airplane analogy. Yeah. Who's that guy with the? He just put on his hat and things and walked right in.
Yeah. You know, bang on the door when you get on an airplane and say, "Can I see your the history of your, you know, how many times you've been in this seat?"
Have you seen the kid who's been arrested like twice now for impersonating a doctor? Yeah, awesome. I'm waiting for the day where the guy walks in as a pilot and he's just like, I can do this. There's a lot of buttons here, but I know where the throttles are, and this looks like the steering yoke.
Yeah, the other thought that was made too about being an internal decision, not just a, you know, am I going to try and prevent myself from catching the flu?
Yeah, Roger.
And then there was one other thought, which has flown away. So, speaking of flying,
if you remember it, let us know.
I was going to say that to Randall's point, there actually is a lot of good evidence. So, if we're basing a lot of what we believe on certain manuscripts or paper from 2,000 years ago or longer, you know, we do have a burden of evidence that is much greater than other evidence. So to this point, there are 5 manuscripts of Ulysses that have been found, and nobody questions the words of Ulysses. There's 5 of them, they differ slightly, but there's no questions. But there's thousands of manuscripts in the New Testament. The Dead Sea Scrolls, the Old Testament is even better. We're talking jot and tittle differences between hundreds of thousands of words. But people question it like crazy.
And that, you know, the delta that you bring up there of, you know, I've heard some people make the counterpoint of, well, nobody thought Ulysses actually spoke those words. What he means is that Homer wrote the words that were written there. I think that when you ask that diagnostic of somebody, when you bring up exactly the classes of evidence that he's talking about, you can get a good sense of the bias of the individual by their initial reaction. Now, I'm not saying that it doesn't bear scrutiny. Let us scrutinize it to the nth degree. But the initial reaction you get will tell you something both about yourself, your own initial reaction, and the other one. And what I would, you know, we as Christians, by the way, are just as guilty as the atheist or agnostic of defending what it is that you think that you want to believe before you bother giving the other side's hypothesis a shot. And all I'm saying is my experience on occasion, I'm as biased as the next guy, but that I have at times in my life opened the window up to such a degree that I've said, I will do the absolute best I can to be as double blind to this as I possibly can, as objective as I possibly can. And it's during those windows of willing to drop my own defensiveness that I've actually learned more, and even learned more about how the faith is stronger than I thought it would have been otherwise. So I encourage you to do that, but I also encourage you, don't do that in a vacuum. Make sure you've got some people on both sides that can give you, nobody's clever enough to come up with all the answers on their own, nobody. So it's good to make sure that you got sources of information that you trust on both sides. Daniel and then Randy. Good point, thank you.
So you can find evidence for this stuff, but I feel there could be different interpretations of the evidence, and I use so I think, you know, there is historical evidence for that Jesus did exist and all, but there's a lot of contention about who Jesus was. Like, I guess the Jews will say that he
was he just a rabbi? Was he a claimant to the Messiah? But, you know, met a sticky end, all that. Yeah, right.
And I lost my
No sweat. I will answer the question I think you were headed towards in the direction you were going, which is, to Daniel's point, I think when you turn around and you do open up the aperture that widely, and you say, I want to examine this and I want to know that it's true, one of the things I concluded was this. We want to say, I know something for 100% certainty that I cannot possibly be wrong about this. Even you know, the atheist that I described to you, point of Jesus appeared to him in person, told him who he was, showed him the holes in his hands, and he still didn't believe it because there's just that room possibly for doubt. If your standard is that high, I agree. You will never meet the standard. And Randy has done a lot of good thinking in this vein of how much can I doubt? Can I doubt that I'm doubting? Can I doubt that I even exist, that I'm even an independent mind? These kinds of things are things that you can reasonably doubt. So if you want to say, I know something 100% and that's how you define it, then I think that there are very few things that you will ever claim to know. So you either end up in a position that says, well, I don't know anything at all. I don't even know if I exist. So I'll go wandering around this world. My point is you still end up making assumptions. One of my points is you would still end up making assumptions. While you're doubting, let's say that Randy has gone as ultra skeptic as he possibly can. He walks out of this class, he's like, I don't even know if I exist anymore. I can't be certain that I exist. What does Randy do? Does Randy go walk down the stairs, or does he leap off the balcony? Does he walk out the door? Does he try to walk through the wall? Does he look both ways before crossing traffic? When he sees a policeman, does he slow down from 70 miles an hour to 45 miles an hour? These are all indications that he believes there's an external world, and he believes it to such a degree that he's changing what his will does. I don't think God's going to ever judge you based on to what degree you know anything. I think God's going to judge you based on what choices you made given what was presented to you. So if you want to stand before the throne of God after you die and say the following, I'm not 100% certain that anything that I experienced in life was even true. It could have all been happening in your head or my head. God's answer might be, fine, what did you choose in your dream? Because now I'm interested in what you chose. Because what you choose in a dream and what you choose in reality, both of them might be your will. I think have to be your will. And God's interested in what we choose. He's not interested in how many atoms made up your body, maybe. So, The skepticism thing is good. One must do it if one wants to be intellectually honest. But at the end of the day, you have to say, and this is my whole point, where's the standard? Is the standard 100%? Well, then you don't believe anything. But even though you claim that you want to know to a standard 100%, you still look both ways before crossing the street. You still go get the flu shot. You still, don't do drugs of a certain type. You still eat food occasionally of a certain type. You've chosen what kind of food to eat, that kind of thing. So all of these things are indications that you believe things on lower standards than not you. People believe things on lower standards than they actually claim. I'm just saying, don't be a hypocrite. Be consistent with your standard. To ourselves, to Christians, and to non-Christians.
Piggybacking on that, I feel like the facts and the 100% truth are used more as a shield to defend the person from what they actually don't want to admit to themselves.
I think that's true. That's absolutely true. That is true. And it's true on both sides, but it's true of the skeptic, it's of the agnostic, of the atheist, and it's true of the Christian who's unwilling to examine their own faith. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about that. Okay, there's no way the next topic was about what the what nature is when we're talking about things like human nature and all that kind of stuff. It can't be done in 10 minutes. So why don't we continue down this vein until class, or if anybody's got any other question, now would be a time to ask it. Or are there any other points on this subject? Yes, sir.
I know an agnostic family, and they say that they're pretty satisfied with like how they live, and they say they're pretty happy and all. And then it's very hard to talk to them about like religion and stuff. So it's usually the people that are religious that are the most happiest. So how do you respond to a person like?
All right, good question. I'll restate it. He knows a family of agnostics that say, I'm actually pretty happy, and I don't know whether God's there. I don't care whether God's there. Maybe I don't care, but it's not an important question to me. Why? Because I'm happy. And what do you say to such people? Well, so let me make the point very clearly. You can be happy without God, and without believing in God. You can be happy. You can be good. You can do good things without believing in God. I just don't think you can do them logically consistently. And while I also make the point, you can be happy. So let's say that they're happy. And you say, how happy are you? Let's say I'm a 9 on a scale of 10. Well, if you become a Christian, you can be a 9.5 on a scale of 10. They'll be like, well, for that 0.5, I'm just not that terribly interested in going to church and doing all the other, and tithing and all the other things that am I supposed to do. So why? What if I'm as happy as I think? Remember that my inquiry. I'll go back to it. My inquiry was a particular one. It said that as a selfish person, what I'm actually interested in are two major questions. I want to be as happy as I possibly can be. So one of the things I would say to them is, the reason Christianity is a good thing is my two questions about, I want to be happy as I can be, and I want to be as happy for as long as I possibly can, which basically means I want to live as long as I possibly can. On the first question, Christianity offers a slight but key advantage. I will bet you that if you dig in deeper into what makes the agnostic family happy, you will find that it is probably highly dependent on circumstance. It's easier to be happy in Northern Virginia than it is in Rwanda. It's easier to be happy when your family's holding together well and things are going well than when your family's falling apart and then divorces are happening and people aren't happy with each other. Now they are unhappy. Christianity, I would point out to people who I would call, I could go, because I don't know Madam very well, let's say that if one examines her life, we have seen that she's been through some very hard things, but the people around her agree that she has maintained this bizarre sense of happiness, contentment, and joy through some of the toughest times of her life. That is an interesting point to follow up on. How did she manage to do that? How has she armored herself against circumstantial change? What I believe is that Christians who live their faith very well look exactly like that. They look like they are impervious to external threats to their happiness. In fact, sometimes it looks like the higher the external threat to the happiness is, the greater their joy is. That is a point that must be followed up on. But let's call that the weaker point. The stronger point is, do you like being happy? I certainly do. How would you like to be as happy as you possibly do? Do you guys have a loving family? Yes, in fact, that's part of why we're happy. How would you like to have a love relationship with your family forever? And how would you like to love somebody and be supported by somebody who knows everything about you, is dedicated to your own happiness, and who wants to be in a love relationship with you as well? And by the way, the side benefit of this particular relationship is you live forever. Now, if you're really interested in being happy for as long as you can be, and I think everybody really is when they think about it, to not investigate immortality is stupid. I mean, imagine Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. Everybody remember? Anybody not read Harry Potter stuff? Okay. What was the Sorcerer's Stone? What did it do for you? It gave you two things. Anybody remember what it was? You could produce the elixir of life so you could live forever on it. And what was the other thing that it did? Turned anything you wanted to into gold. So basically, you could have as much money as you wanted to for your whole life. But you had to be careful. You flood the market with the gold that you produce with it. So some economic considerations. You got to listen to some of those guys. But look what the elixir of life, the magic thing, which, by the way, that's in Harry Potter, but that's an old alchemy goal. People have been after that for 1,000 years. They want riches, which they correlate to happiness usually, and they want immortality. And the owner of the stone, Nicholas Flamel, in the Harry Potter series, lived to be, anybody remember how old he lived to be? Interestingly, she chose this number, 666 years old, before he opted to give up the stone and give it back to Dumbledore. I don't know why she chose that number. The goal that people have when you go through literature, when you go through psychology, when you ask a person to be honest, is they really do want to be as happy as they can possibly be. They want to be as happy for as long as they can possibly be. And so my response to the agnostic family is, hey, I can tell you from my own experience, and I can show you the scientific and historical evidence that people who believe in this system both are happier than you are now, and they are immortal. So why would you not? Why wouldn't you look into it?
But the flip side, the kind of counter to it, and you touched on a little bit, the reality is we don't know what makes us happy. The things that we think make us happy do not. But we fall into the same traps over and over and over again. So if you can find what actually makes you happy, it will not be where your intuitions lie. The idea of, hey, I can have as much gold as I want. I can be as rich as I want. That does not necessarily equate to happiness, even though that's what we all say.
So good. Now a point that I can actually argue, because I disagree with you vehemently. Let me give it a shot. The belief that wealth will make you happy is acquired knowledge. It is not intuitive. I agree with you 100% that intuition is where you have to start. We all have to start with intuition, because it's the initial part that we're examining. Intuition, true intuition, says the following. Despite what everybody in modern society, let's take our own society right now. What is our own society's lesson on love? What do they tell you? And y'all have a good one. We'll be done in a couple minutes here. What do they tell you about love? Can happiness really be found in love? It used to be, I would tell you 40 years ago, we might have said yes. There were the princess stories. We lived happily ever after when you live in love. Now, that is not the lesson of modern society. The lesson of modern society is you cannot depend on these kinds of relationships, and so you need to shore up your happiness in other ways. I think that that's the lesson that is taught in psychology, in counseling, in advertising, in marketing, in movies that we watch, in books that we read. It's that you cannot depend solely on the relationship of love, as an example, to make you happy. There has to be other stuff there. Nicholas Sparks can't write a book now where the protagonists are not divorced or widowed, or there's some major problem in there. It's no longer just the simple love story. It's got some major twists in it, usually relationally. Not that I'm a big Nicholas Sparks reader. Don't walk away with that particular conclusion either. But the intuition is our normal intuition that we're trying to be, that I think people are trying to train us out of, is that love will make us happy, not riches. And you have to be taught the opposite, that riches will make you happy. And then as it turns out, I think you're right, that is a bankrupt that is a bankrupt decision, so conclusion. And I think that the data support that. So when you turn around and you say, by the way, here are some of the data, this maybe supports Skyler's point as much as my own. There is a correlation between how much money you make and how happy you are, up to a very low number. And that number in Northern Virginia might be something like $40,000-$50,000. It's just above the poverty line. It's basically the point at which you're not having to worry about where your next meal comes from. Past that point, it doesn't matter whether you make $75,000 or $75 million. People report being just as happy on anywhere in that scale. So when it comes to money, to needs, yes, there's correlation to happiness. When it comes to riches, where we define riches as beyond need, there is no correlation to happiness. Isn't it interesting, by the way, that Jesus talks about God providing you not riches, but needs? He appeared to know 2,000 years ago that our happiness stops correlating with what we have at need. Don't worry about what you will wear. Don't worry because the grass of the field, you know, we're not dressed like Solomon. Don't worry about your own life because the birds of the air are sold for 2 pennies. Does not your Heavenly Father care more about you? These kinds of ideas are ones that suggest that the Christian worldview, I think, which is, now we would say is counterintuitive. I think that you and I think initially that it's counterintuitive because our society has taught us that those things are true. I think that kids this big know that love is more, sense that love is more important than toys.
That's why it's a story.
Because they also were trained out of it.
Yeah. So it's not modern. That's my...
You're right. It's not modern. I agree.
Okay.
Agreed. It's not a modern thing. No, intuition. My point was intuition. You have been, both in ancient culture and modern culture, we have been trained, the intuitions that we have been countered in whatever their version of what Pepsi and Coke were back in the day. They were trained out of that one from the get-go, from culture. I actually think that the intuitions, go with the intuitions initially, and you'll find that those are the ones that are satisfied by, which ultimately are the ones that we get to. Now we have to work our way back to our own intuitions that we had initially. I think that I can be just happy with love. No, you need to be happy with motorcycles, airplanes, skydiving, and whatever else. I try all those things. Oh, they don't make me happy. Maybe I should go back to love. Oh, well, that actually worked out. 35 years later, I came to the answer. 50 years later, I come to the answer. You have to work your way back to the intuition that God gave you initially. I think we train people out of it at a very early age, and that's the reason that we have so much trouble learning. All we've done is made ourselves take longer to make the decisions.
Twist on it. So we humans have a tendency towards positive confirmation bias, so I want to push back against that and say, is the opposite true? What do you say to the Christian who says, I am unhappy in the Christian faith?
Well, the easy short answer is, I'll take another shameless plug for Verifier. Hey, if you don't think Verifier ain't working, you ain't using it right. Like, we've tested this thing 1,000 times. We know for a fact that it works. It works under the following circumstances. Use it within the following circumstances. To the Christian that says, I'm not happy, my diagnostic immediately goes to, what do you think the Christian tenets are, and are you following them? And you will find a delta between the two. Say again.
So your answer would not be, or not, you would not factor into your consideration the horizontal test, for lack of better terms. That is, if you weren't a Christian, how unhappy would you be?
So let's call it the Bayesian analysis, where we take the naive estimate and say, given no prior, what is your prior probability of happiness here that you're not a Christian? And then let's compare that to the fact that you are a Christian and say, compared to that prior, how do those probabilities compare? Yes, I'm with you. I gotcha. But what I would say is, since I'm arguing for the idea of Christianity being being the fix. I've already kind of come to that conclusion myself. The first thing I want to check as the scientist looking at their experiment is, did you have all the equipment plugged in correctly and were you following the protocols? So if someone turns around and says, I'm using this computer in this experiment, and I'm hitting the key, and it's not changing from one screen to another, my first question is, which key are you hitting? And if the answer is, I'm hitting the space bar, and I'm like, well, read the directions, it says hit the enter key. So if they're doing something wrong, you don't turn around and be like, well, the experiment, the hypothesis is wrong. They might be doing the experiment wrong. And if they're not following the protocol, they're not doing the experiment right. It's the same one of a great example of exactly what he's talking about. Everybody's concerned about antibiotics. Do you know why antibiotic use is a problem? It's not because we're using antibiotics. It's because we're not using antibiotics when we have been prescribed them. So if you are given antibiotics to take for 8 days and you take them for 4 days and you feel better and you stop taking the last four, the problem is you don't kill off the actual strongest versions of that bug. And so you killed off the weak guys, but the stronger ones live. And that means that you just made a new batch of stronger bacteria because you didn't take all of your meds. That's the difference right there. So in this case, my question is, the prescription was for X days of antibiotics. Are you doing X days of antibiotics, or are you doing something differently?
I guess my...
And this will kind of be the last because we're out of time.
My last little pushback would be, doesn't that kind of risk the thing of like, okay, you got a person who's not happy, and then you're telling them, you're doing it wrong.
Yeah.
Get better. Like,
absolutely so. True. So you're right. I did say my first thing would be to be like, what are you doing wrong? In a gentle, Christ-like manner, you attempt to work your way towards finding out if they actually are following the recommendations of Almighty God. And you're right. If I present things in class differently than I would to somebody in that situation, right? So no, that's a great point. And it gets to something that we haven't talked about a lot in this class, because this class isn't a coaching course on how to interact with people of different mindsets. This class is about giving you the information. And then there is a further step, which is you need to interact with those people in a way that isn't off-putting. And I'm not exactly the greatest person to ask that question of, so find some other people that you might trust in that vein. Okay, we are out of time, but thank you for your attention and your excellent discussion back and forth. We look forward to starting our two-year series next time. And if you've got any questions, concerns, or last-minute recommendations before we start next time, this week would be a great week to do it.